Welcome to Bottom Line's Top Dollars,
a podcast about all the money things that you suspect might be ruining your life.
I'm Laura Boo, recording from the city of Charlottetown, which is on the island of Abegwicht, unceded Mi'kmaq land, otherwise known as Prince Edward Island, Canada.
And I'm Hadassah Damian in Brooklyn, New York, on Lenape land.
Together, we are the Ladies Who Crunch, longtime friends, artists, and researchers who have both somehow made careers for themselves in finance.
And in today's episode, we are going to talk to you good people about what happens if you live fast but then don't die young. That's right. We're talking about dealing with death, both yours and others.
A really upbeat topic today.
Yeah, like something that's just going to, you know, keep it extremely real, because death is like the greatest fuck it of all, you know. But it truly is, right? Like I do feel like if I could think back to my young punk self, I would be like, that's it. I'm going to be listening to Skinny Puppy. Like, I'm just going to like go out in like a tub of glitter and like just burn it down. Fuck all of you, which is one approach. And then, at least for me, and I think for some other people I've talked to, when that doesn't happen, you are confronted with the reality of your continued existence and eventual mortality. And so that's what we're going to dig into today, right? It's not just like, fuck you, fuck debt, fuck the state. There's actually all this stuff to talk about when you're thinking about your own death. And also real pragmatically, when the death of other people that you love is something you experience, which is highly likely to happen to all of us.
I mean, and happening more for me, like as I get older, I feel like I had a lot of friends who were like, whatever, I'm dying young, no problem living for today. A lot of people that I know did not expect to live to be old.
You know, 31.
Yeah, like the age I am now is the age that a lot of them did not expect to live to. And, you know, some of them didn't and a lot of them did. But like in the last several years, I'm dealing more and more with the death of my family and friends. And specifically 2 years ago, when I dealt with my father's death after a very long illness, I learned so much about what it means on like a really practical and unfun level of how you have to deal with like shit when someone dies. And I think that this is something that also made me think a lot about my own death, because when you end up being that person who is not just going to the funeral, but having to plan the funeral, deal with the estate, it's impossible for you to not think, oh my God, I don't want anyone to have to deal with this when I die.
Totally. And I think, you know, there's like also COVID, right? Like so many people have died from COVID-19, and so many people know someone / are close to someone who died from COVID. So, you know, the rate of needing to think about this stuff was accelerated by that. And then also good people. Yeah. To Laura's point, the longer you live, the more people you know who will die. That's just facts. And so today we really wanted to dig into not just like death in general, but like why death is a money issue. So Laura, why are we going to talk about death?
Death, unfortunately, is actually very expensive. And so there's a few kind of averages here. In Canada, the low end of what you're going to pay for a funeral is probably around $1,500. The high end, I mean, in many ways, sky's the limit, like everything in the consumer world. But, you know, a high end funeral is maybe $20,000. And the average cost of a funeral in Canada is about $8,500. And this is comparable to the United States. The national median cost for a funeral in the United States in 2019 was about $7,600. And both those numbers are in local currencies, right? So that's a big money issue for a lot of people, especially if it is an unplanned and unforeseen cost.
Yeah, $8,000 is not something most of us have like loitering in our checking account.
Yeah. And it's the kind of cost where you're also like, of all the things you want to spend money on, it's often very unhappy money. And then beyond that, not just talking about the cost of the funeral, there's also the settlement of the estate afterwards, which depending on what the circumstances are, whether you left a big estate or no estate, there's at minimum paperwork to do, but there's also costs associated with it.
And Laura, what goes into an estate if someone doesn't know?
Okay, so an estate is basically what we call what you leave after you die. Like you're your net assets after you die. So in your life, you have a lot of things that you own and a lot of money that you owe to others. So you might own a house, but have a mortgage on it. So that's something that you quote unquote own, but also money that you owe to somebody. All of the possessions that you have in your life, if you have any other assets like a car or a cottage or anything, your record collection, all of that is technically your estate. It's what you own, but now there's no one left to own it. So for this temporary time after you die, we call it your estate. And that's all of your stuff when it's in transit to who is going to inherit it. The process of transferring it from your ownership to the ownership of your various inheritors costs money. It generally costs between 2-5% of the value of your estate to transfer that estate. This cost varies not only based on where you die and therefore what laws apply to your death, state, province, federal, but also depends on what kind of planning you did as far as what structure your assets are in and what kind of assets you're leaving to people. You know, if your only asset is your house, you will also have selling costs if your family decides to sell it. So the transfer of an estate can be really easy if you have nothing and really complicated if you have things.
And so much of, you know, what kind of shows up to add to the complexity here is like what I think of as like legal relationships versus social relationships. And that's part of why we wanted to talk about this topic, because in the world of like estates and death and dying, the state sees only very specific relationships as connected to you. And so that would be like biological family, people who you're legally wedded to. Those are like the default relationships. But for so many of us, we have other extremely valuable relationships, like our chosen family, our platonic life partners, our partners who we have chosen not to be married to, right? And I think for a lot of queer people in particular, but I know this applies to other folks as well, there's also those of us who have families who we're not friendly with, who we don't want the state connecting us to, forced connecting us to in our death, right? So we're going to talk about some of the ways that we can be really intentional about what's going to happen to our stuff, regardless of the types of relationships that you have. Like, how can you just honor all of those relationships and, if needed, block relationships that need blocking, while being aware that, yeah, it is not free to die.
So sad. It's like such bullshit.
It's total capitalism has financialized our literal death. Like in the US, you'll get a Social Security payout of, I think it was $220 when someone dies, which is like not even a day's wages to take off and cry, you know, or like barely a day's, like it's slap in the face level. And so look, let's get into it. Like, we're going to structure this podcast in terms of thinking about when other people die and things you can do to manage the deaths of others, and then also ourselves, right? And there's like, what can we do to prepare and plan for our own passing? And I think with this, we're going to dig into how you can maybe come up with some of these numbers, how you can like think about having these conversations. So let's get in. Laura, start us off. Like, you've had this really tragic experience of losing your dad. Like, what do you want people to be thinking about with like death of a relative or a parent?
Well, on a, like a really personal level, when my dad died, for me, going and dealing with the funeral plans in a way was something to focus on. So I actually kind of got into it with like, and really tried to help my mom. So there's my mom, my sister, and I. My father had been sick for a very, very long time, but he had been unable to participate in telling us what he wanted at all, because my father had early onset Alzheimer's for 10 years before his death. And we took care of him at home and he passed away. And then we were left with making all these decisions about things that we had not talked to him about. So we went to a funeral home. They give you a list of like the to-do list of what you have to do to deal with the remainders of your loved one. And we chose to get the funeral home to do a lot of the paperwork for us, but you can also choose to do a lot of it yourself if you want to do that. But basically, when someone dies, you are going to have to deal with the paperwork of proving that they're dead. So getting a death certificate of some kind, which depending on where you live is either issued by the hospital or a funeral home or someone else. In Canada, there is a fee for the death certificate that you have to pay for. And this death certificate, you need it for a lot of reasons, including dealing with the estate, but also, you know, filing for any kind of benefits like the insurance, also I needed the death certificate to prove to Air Canada that I should get the bereavement rates for traveling to my father's funeral. So you need the death certificate.
It's so extra to be like, please show us your grief form. Like, all right, here's my grief form. Yeah.
It is really extra. Honestly, you're going to deal with a lot of bureaucracy where people will take a really gentle voice with you and then tell you really nasty shit. I got into a fight with Air Canada about them allowing my same-sex partner to get access to the bereavement rates. I had to escalate it in order for them to accept it and give us our money back. Anyway, it's horrible.
And I think that's just back to all of this, like, what relationships count in the moments when we are, like, connecting with bureaucratic systems and with state-related systems. Again, biological family counts. Wedded spouses count. Everybody else is invisibilized unless there's something specific to visibilize them. And that's part of why this planning ahead on this stuff matters when you have creative and expansive social relationships. And also that sucks, Laura, that you had to like talk to the manager on that one.
Yeah. It took like 6 months and it was really annoying, but you know, other costs, like we didn't have this cost. We had this cost, but it was just from the hospital to the funeral home. But you might have to pay for transportation of the body. And this is more expensive if the person that you love dies far away from where you are going to have the funeral or the ceremony or whatever. So, you know, the death certificate and transportation, you don't have choices in those. You have to get the death certificate. You have to bring the body to where it is that you want it to be, depending on where the person died. Those things, not a lot of options. But then there's like a whole, dare I say, menu of options about how you want to plan the funeral. And this is where you start to make these consumer decisions for which there is a very wide range of price tags. And this is where you start to feel like you're in a state of being very emotional. And unless somebody left you specific plans about what to buy, you start to feel freaked out about being cheap or doing the thing they wanted to do.
Totally. You're like, unless I know that you really, really were like, just throw me in a rag. I don't want to be cheap at someone I loved. I want to be respectful. I want to honor the dead. Like all these cultural feelings and expectations I can imagine we didn't know were in our minds show up around how we're going to take care of somebody who we loved and cared about after they're gone. So yeah, there's body preparation options in terms of like, there's like more expensive, like embalming, getting your makeup done. And embalming has only been around for like not even 200 years. You know, in some traditions, embalming wouldn't really even necessarily be an option, right? Like in some variations of Jewish traditions, like you die, you are in the ground within 24 hours. Like embalming is not, there's no point, right? There's less expensive options, also like burial without embalming. Again, you go in the ground pretty quick, cremation, or there's like no prep for viewing. But then there's also traditions that don't embrace, for example, like when you're Catholic, people don't embrace cremation because it, you know, Laura, you were saying like it could lead to ancestor worship of the ashes.
Yeah, like Catholics don't want you to have the dead person in your house forever. That's kind of like an old school Catholic thing, which my family on Prince Edward Island is old school Catholic. And we did cremate my father because it was my mother's wishes, and my mother's Catholic family is less old school. And no one said anything, but like not that long ago, you know, in my lifetime, there are Catholic churches on Prince Edward Island that wouldn't do funerals for cremated bodies. Cremation tends to be for many your cheapest option for dealing with a body. But depending on whether or not religion is in play, that might not be an option for you.
Right. And then this starts to bring in all the like, what sort of like funeral or end of life celebration might you be choosing to have? Do you need to pay for space at a funeral parlor? Or if the person who died like had a religious community, like how do you make arrangements with their like place of worship for an end of life ceremony? Will there be a, you know, food afterwards? Will people be flying in? Will you be getting hotels for anybody? Like, will there be flowers there? And then it leads into like, if you're going to have this type of event, will you be viewing either the body or the ashes in a container? So like now we're asking where are the remains? Is it in like a cardboard box? Is it in a nice vase? Is it in like a medium nice coffin? Is it in like a really nice casket? You know, is it in like, is there a viewing casket and a burial casket? Like there are so many potential variations on cost here.
And it's really overwhelming. I feel like us talking about this is not just being like, wow, the funeral industry is bonkers, which in a way it is. It's also that these decisions that you end up having to make, you are making them in a state state where you are grieving, and you can be in various states of being functional or not functional, you don't have a lot of time to make these decisions, right? Like, in general, funerals have to happen pretty quickly after somebody dies. And if you need more time, then you have to pay for it because you'll have to preserve the body or store it somehow. So you either have to make the decisions very, very quickly, or you have to literally buy yourself more time to make decisions. So the options, it's like endless. Literally, it's like wedding planning. Everyone knows how wedding planning can, you can go to the moon. It's the same thing with a funeral. You can go to the moon with flowers and ceremony and whatever. If there's not a lot of instructions left, then you are left to make those decisions on your own and potentially have to negotiate those decisions
and those costs
with others. So for us, it was my sister, my mother, and I who made the decisions about what we were and were not going to do. And my father did not leave instructions, but, you know, like, we're Catholic family, small town, like literally there's the Catholic funeral home and the Protestant funeral homes. Like, you know where you're going.
Okay, well, that makes it easy at least.
I guess we went pretty middle of the road. You know, we just kind of made those decisions and moved on. It was not easy. And to be frank, if we would have had discussions with my father before he had become unable to have those discussions, then we would have saved a lot of pain and suffering, because the decision to cremate my father was not easy. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really conflict, but my mother was conflicted because she didn't know whether to follow her family traditions so that he could be with her, or to follow his family traditions and then they would not be together. So it was a really difficult decision, and it was difficult because they hadn't talked about it. One thing that you can do when you have people around you who you would be responsible for, like, it's not just waiting until your loved ones get ill. It's anyone who you mm-hmm. know you would be responsible for. I know which people in my life I would be responsible for if they died. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And anyone can die at any time, whether they're young or old. And those are simple conversations like, do you want to be buried or cremated? Or, you know, now there's a lot of other options besides burial or cremation. There's a lot of new kind of eco
shroud options. There's also eco activism. Anyway, yeah, like, but what do you want? No, Laura, the point, Laura, that you're making is really valuable. It's like the conversations that lead to a general plan, because there's so many levels of things that need to be thought through. Like we've only gotten through like day, whatever, three after someone has passed, and you've gotten them, their body dealt with and people together, right?
Yeah. And you've spent like $7,000.
Right? Like, where, you know, you're still asking and answering questions like, where does the body go? Is it going into the ground? Is it like coming home? Like, again, after that chapter is done, then you go into the sort of into the executor estate chapter. The executor is essentially who's the person in charge of the dead person's money and stuff, like what Laura's talking about, who's responsible when somebody else dies. And this is a conversation that you really want to have, because that responsible person is signing for things. They're the spreadsheet maven. They're making sure that final taxes are getting filed. They have to go find where the money is. They're paying for the funeral. They're paying for like the final trailing financials. Like, they're closing out the financials of this person and the assets of this person. And so what you do want is to have a specific executor named for your stuff. Because if you don't have a specific executor in the US, you'll just be assigned a random person through the state to look through all of your paperwork.
If you're unmarried or if you are married. Because I don't think that my father had an executor, but my mother just dealt with it because they were married.
That might, okay, back to legal relationship, right? Like, I don't actually know. Like, it might be if you're married, it just goes to your spouse. But here's where everything's a little bit different in every location, yeah. Right? And you, again, ask yourself, if you're not married and not planning to get married, who is going to be responsible? Is it your random brother? Is it your... Is it your chosen, you know, is it your like preferred sibling? Like, how do you want to actually have these conversations and like let the person know what you want and set them up to succeed as well, right?
And what happens if you're the executor? Like, so if you get tapped and you are this person and you have to deal with all these things, that can either be a simple thing that you can, you know, get help through a lawyer or help through, you know, people who specialize in this. And of course, again, you will have to pay fees for that. And it also depends on whether or not you're the executor for an estate that has a lot of things or an estate that has no things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge difference in Canada, at least, between the death of somebody who had a legal spouse, a surviving legal spouse, and the death of somebody who did not. Because in Canada, if you have a surviving legal spouse, then in general, things just transfer to them. Unless there's specific instructions that that should not happen, then in general, the default is it mostly transfers and it's quote unquote like a smoother process. But as the executor, you will end up having to do a lot of paperwork. You will have to be the one who does things like dealing with the final bill from the funeral home, dealing with the final tax return that you have to file. In Canada, there's literally what they call a terminal return, which you have to file.
Not an airport. Either,
you have to file either by April 30th of the following year or within 6 months if the death occurs, in essence, less than 6 months before April 30th. It's basically the estate filing a tax return for itself, and it's flagging it as the last tax return of the estate. If there is a spouse, it generally transfers anything inherited by the spouse tax-free. And if there are other types of inheritors, then the estate will pay tax on those assets before transferring them out of the estate and into the possession of the inheritors.
And so something I'm thinking about too is like for all my punk friends who like got married for health insurance or like got married for random reasons and have like, you know, there's a couple of you out there who are like have like a random person you're married to. Just double check on that because like that person is de facto going to get your shit. Maybe that just means your record collection. Maybe it doesn't. You definitely just want to kind of like stay on top of who's the legal relationships in your life.
Oh yeah. Being randomly still married if you die really, really blows. Like it really messes everything up. And I know so many people who got married, people who are like, oh yeah, getting married. It wasn't a big deal to get married. We broke up and we didn't want to pay the money to file the papers to get divorced because it doesn't bother us. We're both with other people now and it doesn't matter that we're still married. I know tons of people like that.
It matters.
It matters. Like if you were married to someone and that person passed away, you would then be implicated in that person's estate, even if you didn't want to be.
Yeah.
You would now be involved in dealing with that person's stuff.
Right. Unless that person was like airtight on their like will and executor and all that. But if they're type A like that, you probably are already divorced. Right. So like, so this is I'm right. Like, look, everyone, this is like the level of detail paperwork that all of us would like to avoid. It's nice to avoid it until it happens to you. And then you're like, why did I avoid this? So Laura and I are really trying to like set all of us up for both our own experiences with other people dying, but other people experiencing our deaths to make that suck less.
I was going to say one last thing about other people dying before I feel us moving to the point where we talk about thinking about our own deaths. The experience of someone dying is extremely different on a money level, depending on whether or not your family is rich or poor, mm-hmm. whether or not your family has resources or does not. So someone passing away and they left a big estate, then you know what? Paying for their funeral, passing on the assets, it's probably going to be a ton of paperwork and it's probably going to take you between 12 and 18 months to figure out the estate and for inheritance to actually pass through. But there will be money to pay for a funeral. There will be money that comes to you in the end. But what happens if there's nothing? This is a situation where, you know what, there's not really an executor. Maybe there's no will. There's no things. And the estate kind of collapses and there's, you know, basically you just have to file a tax return and whatever, you know, people might come and take some of your clothes or records or whatever, but there's not really stuff. What happens with the funeral costs? So if you end up in this situation where you really can't afford to pay for the funeral, there's some financial assistance for that in Canada. If you can't pay for a loved one's transfer, burial, cremation, or anything on your own, you might be able to apply for help from the government. So if the person who died was eligible for what we call the CPP death benefit, CPP is the Canada Pension Plan. So if the person who died had a job, like a legit job where they paid into EI and CPP and taxes and the whole thing, they had a Medicare card, if they were in the system like that, then you can apply for this death benefit, which is $2,500, which
is less than $8,000, but is more than $255, which is what you get in the US. Hey.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can have the most basic burial for barely, if you do the cheapest possible thing, it would in most places probably cover the absolute basics.
Okay.
But if they were not eligible for that, you can apply to the government, because in Canada, there's this thing about they don't want anyone, any Canadian, to be denied the dignity of a funeral. And so if there is no CPP benefits, then you can apply to the province or the municipality to cover basic funeral services. It's basically like a pauper's funeral, and it includes a casket, cemetery, and cremation fees. You know, you don't get any choices in any of these things. And this is usually primarily offered to people who were already in the welfare system.
Right. Yeah. In the US, there's like some of the like city, town, county levels have like additional funds available that you can apply to for similar level, like basic cremation slash like end of life death costs. But I think the point is that it's like knowing that those are available, important. Knowing that these things are going to cost money, important, just so that like we're trying to set you up to know what to expect. But there's two other things about if when somebody else dies, and I just want to name, like, we're really focusing on like when people who were legally related to dying, but of course, like, so many of us have experienced community members and people that we care about and like friends, deaths of extended friend family. And again, this whole idea of legal relationship makes these a little bit more complicated, because there are only certain people who can really fill out the paperwork, who are tapped in to do all of the stuff when somebody dies. And so again, knowing who that person is, if you're not in a legal relationship with somebody, is really, really important. So you know who you'll be dealing with, right? Is it a parent? Is it somebody else designated? But the two other things I think to talk about real quickly is like inheritance, I want to talk about, because it's like if your person died with any money in the bank, or potentially they own a house, or potentially they had a life insurance policy, or potentially they had some retirement or whatever, and it isn't passing directly to a married spouse. A lot of people ask me like, oh my God, I'm going to get an inheritance. Do I have to pay taxes on it? In the US, the laws changed a couple of years ago. You, the receiver of an inheritance, would only pay taxes if you got more than $11 million, at which point you will totally have enough money to pay taxes. But anything less than $11 million as an inheritance, you're not going to pay any taxes on it. Any taxes that might have had to have been paid, the estate's going to take care of before that money clicks over to you. The other side of the coin, right? Not getting money, but potentially owing money. People are sometimes concerned, look, my parent died with debt. They didn't have a house. They didn't have nothing but credit card debt. You typically cannot inherit debt from a parent unless you co-signed for the debt or applied for the credit together with the person who died. So if your name is on the debt, if you have the house together, if you have the credit card together, the car loan together, then yes, that debt is yours. But if your parent just died with credit card debt or with medical debt or what have you, that doesn't roll forward. That doesn't mean in the US, at least, that like creditors won't try to make you think that you should pay it to them, but they're shady. No, the answer is no, that's not your debt. And again, it's different if you're married to somebody who dies with debt. So again, any of you who are like married to a random person, double check on that.
Yeah, inheriting debt is kind of wild. And in Canada, it's really, really similar as far as like the co-signing. And, you know, when someone dies, their estate essentially settles things. So if you settle with a net plus, the estate pays taxes on it and then passes it on to somebody. If you die with a net minus, then the estate essentially just ends that and the minus does not pass on. I feel like that's important to say that the kind of taxes that an estate will pay really, really depend on what is in the estate. You know, real property like houses or whatever is taxed differently than investments, and investments in Canada versus investments here or there or whatever. Like the structure of someone's estate, the structure of their assets has a big impact on what kind of tax they pay. So if you are somebody whose family doesn't really have a lot of things, then it's a lot simpler. But if you are somebody who has the fortune of having a parent or grandparent or somebody who has assets, then the structure of those assets makes a difference for you. You know, some people spend a lot of time structuring everything perfectly, but I know a lot of people who ended up spending years dealing with the sizable estate estates of their parents or grandparents because, you know, their parents had all this stuff, but they weren't rich enough to have like financial planners who made everything perfect and set up trust funds. They just had a mess of all this stuff that they accumulated, and some of it really valuable, and it was really messy to settle it. I've talked to a lot of friends who are like, this is costing me a ton of money and it causes them a lot of pain. And I try to remind them, I'm like, look, if your parent or grandparent had done something, they could have maybe optimized it and you'd pay less fees and taxes and whatever. But that's over now. Mm-hmm. And in the end, you will get something. You cannot think of it as I'm losing something, because in the end, you are going to get something out of it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The fact that the fees are higher because your parents didn't plan well, thinking about that or latching onto that is just going to bring you so much sadness.
Right. The fees are the fees.
In the end, something will come out. Yeah. Like an inheritance is
a blessing. Oh my God. Yeah.
It's bonkers to me. It's like, I don't have, like, that's not the world I live in. The idea that there would be something left over is mind-boggling to me. The fact that the state takes a piece of it or lawyers take a piece of it or whatever, yes, but, you know, I've seen people get just, it hurts them over the long term because they get trapped into a mire of, if only things had been done better.
I feel like inheritance is a whole other podcast on its own, because I feel like the last thing that I want to say on it, because I do want to move on to what you do to plan for yourself, but it's like, in some ways, inheritance is like not up to you. Like, if your family had any money or not, kind of not up to you for the most part. And then what those people chose to do with it is pretty much not up to you. And the way state taxes are set up, not up to you. And like, I work with a lot of people who have inherited money and feel complicated about it for like a really legitimate variety of reasons, you know, grief, death, money, like they form this like really difficult snarl. So, you know, what I'm hearing from Laura is like, look, like it is what it is. It doesn't have to make it right. But like grinding on wishing like a parent had like structured their assets differently is probably wasted time. However, making sure that you know your parent has, or your loved one or whatever, has a will and you know who's in charge of the whole thing, not wasted time. So let's transition and start talking about the things that we could do, the like non-wasted time things that like we could do to prepare for our own deaths. Because on the one side, like when you see somebody else's or you're witnessing somebody else's experience of another person's death, it's just this kind of come to God moment where you're like, oh, there's things that I could do to get ready.
Oh my God. So much. When my father died, I was like, oh my God, I need to do some things. For me, I was like, I had all these conversations with my spouse about, okay, when I die, this is what I want. This is what I don't mm-hmm. want. And I know that a lot of people are going to be like, oh God, this is the most depressing episode ever.
I hate this list. Why are we doing it? Yeah.
Yeah. But let's talk about planning for our own deaths.
Yes.
What things can we do to prevent our loved ones from having to deal with the worst parts
right.
of you dying?
Yeah. I mean, step one, like we've been talking about, have a conversation and make what you want really clear. Separate from a will with what to do with your stuff is what to do when I die. Like, do you want to be cremated? Do you not want to be cremated? Just make that clear and make sure that somebody knows that it's discoverable information. It's just step one. Which means, morbidly, reflecting on what you want with yourself when you're gone. Like, personally, I want to be buried in the cemetery in my hometown because Susan B. Anthony is there, Frederick Douglass is there. Like, put me as close as possible to these local people who I just feel are, like, great leaders. Like, I want to be dead with the greats, you know, like, where I'm from. Take me home. Fair. Take me the fuck home. You know, but, like, somebody has to know that for that to be possible.
Yeah, as far as leaving instructions about what you want for the disposal of your body, people are like, oh my God, the idea of having to go to a funeral home and make those plans and set that in motion. And because you can go to the length of saying, I'm going to fully plan and prepay for my death. If you are in that position, you can relieve your family and friends from having to think about the cost of burying you by literally going to a place and signing a contract where you buy all the things that you want for yourself. If you want to plot, you pick it out. You want a specific casket.
You pick it out.
You pick it out. The level of doing that for some people feels comforting, but we're not saying that pre-planning what you want requires you to go to that length.
Yeah, you don't have to.
No. It can just literally be leaving at minimum basic instructions.
Right.
For me, my mother, my sister, my spouse know what I would want. In very broad terms, I've been like, I want to be cremated. I don't want you to spend a lot of money on it. And then I want people to get together and have a party. It can be at somebody's house. That's all I care about.
Right. Boom, boom, boom.
Please do not spend a lot of money on it, because I find that to be, for me, not a useful way to spend your money. So don't do it. And I feel like telling people that relieves them of the burden, you know, because I feel like people go through this process where they're like, I can't buy the cheapest casket for my mother. It feels disrespectful. Mm-hmm. But if you're like, hey, like in my kind of punk rock, fuck the world, I don't give a shit if you dispose of my body in the cheapest way possible.
But bury me in my old hoodie, okay? Just take all my hoodies, wrap my body. Like, leave me in my patch pants. Yeah, like, just tell people what you fucking want.
Yeah, and then just relieve them of that burden. And it can be informal, or it can be all the way to the other side of being like, I'm just going to go and pay for it myself, and then people don't have to worry at all.
I will say one other thing about prepaying for death. Like, number one, it's a very, like, AARP move. Like, it's a very retired person. Like, now that you're 65, things to do move. Although, if you chose to do it, I haven't, like, you know, but if you chose to do it, one reason people like it is that you're paying today's prices for tomorrow's problem. And so it's like, lock in your pricing now. So I do have half a mind to get a burial plot for myself now at 2021 prices, just because I don't know what that's going to cost, because I don't know when I'm going to die. So glitter done.
Literally, the real estate prices for burial plots, if people want to be buried, it's just like everything, every other piece of land, it's becoming more and more expensive, which is hilarious to me. And also, small fun fact, like, nowadays, when you buy a burial plot, you're buying pretty much a permanent place for your body to be, which is actually a very new thing. Like, for most of history, if you bought a burial plot, you bought it for a specific number of years, like 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And then at the end of your lease, they would dig you up.
They would dig you up.
They would resell that plot, because the idea was that the earth had already consumed your body. So they would dig up what was remaining and put the remains in a smaller box and put it somewhere smaller.
And the people who were crying were also dead. So there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this was like a Western European way of doing things, when, you know, land is at a premium, and the best cemeteries were the cemeteries where people would rot faster. Like, there was a very famous cemetery in England that people called the Bone Eater, and it was like the most expensive cemetery to rent a place to decompose. Anyway.
Wow. Okay.
This is a whole set of like art history knowledge that is predating becoming an accountant. But anyway.
Okay. So I want to talk about other ways that you might prepay for death. And I'm going to get nice and boring, because I'm talking about life insurance, y'all.
Oh my God, life insurance.
Life insurance. So in 2013, a friend of mine like had an accident, and it really got me thinking about what would happen to me if I had a similar type of accident. And so I went out and got accidental death and dismemberment insurance, a $25,000 policy, and I pay $7 a quarter for it. So like not quite 30 bucks a year. Because I was just like, look, self, you're a bicyclist. You bike all the time in New York City, where, let's be honest, it's dangerous and cars don't care. What's the plan if, you know, you get hit by a truck, which 100% happens to bicyclists in New York? And so I was like, I'm buying this like little tiny cheap life insurance thing, like through my bank. It just gets automatically debited once every 3 months out of my account. And that way there's 25 grand to like take care of, you know, whatever needs to be taken care of for me when I go. And that was my like first just like backup cheap insurance, you know, for folks who are younger, for folks who are like feeling healthier and are just like, what's going to happen to me? It's only going to be like in an accident. Then there's AD&D, accidental death and dismemberment insurance, that also like would cover, you know, if you don't die, but like you need other types of money payouts. So like, it's cheap, it's there. That's like the lowest bar. And then after that, we get into a much more classic life insurance product, which is called term life insurance. And term literally means like it's for a specific term of time. And term life insurance tends to not be quite as cheap as AD&D, but like still cheaper than you would think because it expires after a certain amount of time.
So like 10 years, 20 years, 30 years.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Or like if you have a workplace like insurance option, they're offering you term life insurance and it only applies as long as you are working there, right? So after you retire, it's over. But people really enjoy term life insurance, in particular if you have like a time-based responsibility. Where I see this show up for people, it's two ways. Number one, it's like, I have kids. If I'm not around, I want to make sure that there's like income available for my kid to get them the things they need, start them off in life. Or often people and their spouses will have like term life insurance to like cover the cost of a mortgage. One of them passed away, so the other isn't burdened.
I feel like we need to do a whole episode about insurance in general, because to me, insurance is one of these things that is so complicated and such a tangle, and there's so many options. So I don't want to go too deep into it, but we wanted to mention this because if you are thinking about or planning or want to try to plan for your own death, especially if you have limited current resources and people around you have limited resources and you do not want to have a pauper's funeral or you don't want to leave that cost with your loved ones, then life insurance is an option that you might be able to afford right now that will insulate the people that you love from having to pay out of their own pocket for burying you. So we won't go too much more into that. In the future, there will be an insurance episode at one point.
Oh man, there's so much more we could say. Yeah, but in case you're like, look, ladies who crunch, I don't have $8,000 to just like throw at my future death right now. Maybe you have $6 or $7 every quarter to throw towards a little fund.
If you go to an insurance broker and go to an insurance broker rather than a specific company, because the broker will shop around for multiple offers and say, look, this is my budget. What can I get to make sure that I have something to leave for somebody? Which, to be honest, if you are not going to leave anything for anybody, you know, if your life is such that you're like, you know what? I survive. I take care of me. I want to leave a little bit of something. Life insurance is an option. And as far as the details of it, we'll get there. But let's move on to thinking about your estate.
Your money.
So we've talked about you dealing with other people's estates. Let's talk about what you can do for your estate, especially if you're at a point where you are starting to get more assets in your life. Like if you are somebody who doesn't have a lot of things, then your estate might just be distribution of the physical things that you have, like your books and your record collection and your, you know, for me, my wigs and all my sparkles and my shoes and all my whatever, all my cabaret stuff. In my mind, I know who specific pieces are going to. Even if you only have that, having a plan for how to distribute it is a good thing to do. And so what we're talking about right now is taking time to create a will for yourself.
Dun, 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 dun. A will. Yes. Look, there's like two types of stuff you can have. There's stuff that you can assign what is going to happen to it without a will. And that's life insurance, that's retirement assets, and that's your bank accounts. But everything else, you have to assign where it's going to go with a will, right? And like, again, like legally wedded spouses aside, where there's like a slightly different set of rules where things just kind of bounce over to them. If you don't make a will, you're essentially saying whoever the state thinks is my legal family is who should be deciding about my stuff and getting my stuff. Because if you don't have a will, your stuff cannot go directly to your friends or your bestie or your like PLP or your like non-wedded partners. Okay. It's really, really important that like there be some sort of plan, not just for what happens when you die, but for your stuff after you die, so that the right people are the empowered decision makers to basically get your stuff or to know that all your stuff goes in the garbage or whatever it is you want, as opposed to what somebody else thinks is right.
I've had this funny thing where like for many, many years, I constantly envision what I would write in my will in a very kind of like 19th century, like writing this epic letter to whoever about my stuff. And then I never do it. You know what I mean? And because it seems morbid and it seems like a thing that, you know, you think about, oh yeah, I should. And then you got to do your laundry and your dishes and you have to run your errands and go to work and whatever. And it doesn't seem like you have enough time for it. And this is something that Ariel was talking about, which is if your current life situation is such that there's a very clear line of inheritance based on the fact that you are legally married to the person who you want to get all your stuff, or if you're not, the person who you want to get all your stuff is your closest blood relation. And if there is no strife between any of those people, if you truly are like, you know what, there's no conflict in my family.
No one is problematic.
No one is problematic. No one ever argues. I cannot see a possible way in which anyone will ever get mad at each other about my stuff, then the need for a will is a lot less. But if there's any contention, if there's anything that you want to leave to anybody who is not the most obvious default
legal inheritor
to your stuff, mm-hmm. then you need a will.
Or if your family is shitty, you know?
If your family is
sorry, shitty. Or if they're contentious, or if they're problematic. I mean, I think, Laura, this is one of the differences between you and I. Like, my biological family are problematic. They're like problematic. I'm sorry that they are, you know, like, and so I, like, in some ways I had to make a will to ensure that my, like, money grubbing,
like, bad dad didn't get
yeah,
anything.
Yeah, prosperity gospel, you know, dad didn't, like, try to come for anything that I had ground myself to get. Our almost lawyer in residence gave us some information, which is, here's the thing, like, people who you are legally family to, your biological family and or a wedded spouse, could contest what's in a will. These are the people who would, under the sort of idea of, like, the state and property in the courts, have claim to your stuff. So if for some reason those people in your life are problematic, you want a will that is very, very clear, because they have the legal right to contest the will. And then you want, like, a lawyer-levelly made will, so that if they try to contest it, there's nothing contestable. And, like, so for example, my, like, money-grubbing evangelical dad contested his parents' will when they died, because he just wanted to money-grub and, like, drag whatever, the rest of the family, like, through
some shit.
Just some shit, because he's, like, a horrible money-grubbing person. People can do that. People will do that.
And they can do it with any kind of will. Like, whether you write a letter that you just leave somewhere, or you go to the most expensive lawyer you can find, people can legally contest your will. And this is, like, you know, being real about who is in our lives, is being able to say, I can foresee somebody contesting my will. And if you can foresee that what you want will piss somebody in your family off enough that they would maybe contest it, then you should try to get a more ironclad will. And there's a range of ways you can write your will, from very cheap options that are highly contestable in court to more expensive options. No will is super expensive unless you go bananas. You can go to a lawyer and pay lawyer-like fees and get what is considered to be a much less contestable will.
Right. And so in terms of, like, the will that you can get, there's, like, DIY, like, you know, what's called holographic. So, like, you know, literally handwritten, which have their own kind of, like, extra legal. So, you know, our non-lawyer in residence was saying, like, you can handwrite your will if you're literally a soldier at war, or if you're literally a mariner on a boat. Like, if you're in a sort of moment that is, like, pretty clearly dramatic and, like, might be the end of your life, you can write a will there and then, and it counts.
Like, unwitnessed. As long as it's in your own handwriting. Yep. If you were to type it out and not sign it, anybody could do that. It's about being in your own handwriting and signed by you.
Tell the tractor story.
Okay. So in Canada, there's this great precedent that I heard about, which is, long time ago, there was some farmer out on the prairies in Canada and had an accident out in the field by himself, something like the tractor rolled on him or something. And he was out in the field dying under the tractor for a very long time. And he took some object and scratched into the fender of the tractor that was on top of him a very short set of directions about what he wanted for his stuff. This has become core precedent in Canadian law about holographic wills. In this circumstance where the man was dying, there could be no contesting that this was the most recent holographic will that this person had left, and the fender of this tractor held up as his last will and testament. And this is the thing about writing your own DIY wills, is that if you do multiple versions, the fact that they are unwitnessed witnessed multiple versions can end up creating a lot of conflict because it becomes really uncertain which one was your most recent mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to go that DIY route where you're like, you know what, I'm just going to write a letter. There's a few things that you can do that don't cost you money that make it a little bit less contestable. And, you know, people have different opinions about how good these things are. And I've heard a lot of DIY options, but things like, you know, you can write the letter, put it in your own handwriting, sign it. You can get a witness to co-sign it with you, which helps mm-hmm. because that person can attest that when you wrote that letter, you were of sound mind to make those decisions. I've also heard of people doing things like taking that letter and then mailing it to themselves so that the postmark is on it, so that there's a government agency that has dated it mm-hmm. and they mail it to themselves and then they leave it sealed and they put it somewhere safe, like in a safety deposit box or in a lockbox in their house, and it's labeled on the outside that it's their will.
Right.
So people have done those kinds of things to try and make a DIY free, I mean, I guess the cost of the postage will, mm-hmm. like a little bit less contestable.
Right. So if you don't have stuff that people might get into some fights over, that's like the lowest bar to enter, right? Like the next lowest bar up is like boilerplate stuff online. So like fill in the blanks, basic assets. You can get whatever boilerplate for like $40 to $100 online. You're filling it in, you sign it, you date it, you have two other people sign and date it. So like you're kind of going into the witness zone, like Laura's talking about. Like two other people are like, yes, this person was of sound mind the day that they signed this.
The day we did this on the internet.
The day we did this on the internet together. Very good. You know, for $100 and like an hour or two of your and somebody else's time, you can get this done at the basic level. And then you start getting into like paying a lawyer, which is going to be like between like $500 to $1,000, maybe $1,500 if you have like a lot of different types of stuff. If you happen to want to give your assets to people who are not, back to this idea of legal family, it's worth it because otherwise that's who's going to get your stuff.
Yeah, if you want your best friend to get everything and not your bad dad,
you need a will. You need a will. That is why I have a will.
Yeah, and in Canada, you could also go to a notary. That's the other option. You can do the letter and get it notarized. It's a little bit cheaper. It's like in between the DIY and the lawyer. So there are options.
There are options. And the last thing I think on the stuff though is like if you have retirement accounts, if you have a life insurance account, if you have bank accounts, you can also set up what's called your beneficiaries on your accounts. Accounts that have designated beneficiaries of this type, that money will go directly to those people when you pass away. It doesn't have to go through the whole will process.
It doesn't ever go into your estate.
Right. It does not go into your estate. Therefore, it doesn't go into your will. It's useful to know this again, because say that you're like, I need to do this like quick and dirty and cheap, like on your checking or savings account, you can set up what's called a POD, payable on death. And so, you know, you're me, you're like a crusty bike rider. Like you can set up a POD on your account. You're like, God forbid a truck hits me, this money goes to my best friend. Same thing with like beneficiaries on your investment and retirement accounts. But my suggestion to you all is to go back every couple years and just check who's on those accounts, because sometimes the people you want to get that money has changed. Like, for example, I was looking at one of my retirement accounts the other day, like trying to whatever update something. And I realized that my like ex from 12 years ago was still one of the beneficiaries on that account. And they're a lovely person, but it no longer makes sense for them to get some of that money. So I updated it.
Or like new people come in, like I don't have kids, but I have all these nibblings. And every time a new one comes along, I have to go around and change all my beneficiaries to add the new nibbling so that, you know, they can go to college or something.
Right. Or just like, what, who knows what it'll cost? Get a couple textbooks on me. Good luck, kid. You know?
Yeah. What I like about those things is they are also, they're much more direct. And mm-hmm. if you are very lucky and have lots of stuff, maybe you have like a more complicated thing, like executing a will takes time, but the paying out of life insurance, and if you have like these PODs on your bank accounts and stuff, it's much faster. Mm-hmm. Now, this is also something to think about, like if you have a spouse or somebody else who you want to make sure that if something bad happened to you, that they weren't cut off from your money, you might want to think about having joint accounts, especially if one spouse makes the majority of the money to support the both of you or your family. If the person who is the high earner keeps all their money in an account that only has their name on it and there's no POD set up on it, then if that person dies, your spouse and family might be cut off from the resources that they need to like pay the mortgage, pay the rent, pay for groceries on the short term. So thinking about having those things set up is also making sure that in the delay between your death and the settlement of your estate, which we've said, if your estate is complicated, it can sometimes take 12 to 18 months to settle an estate. You want to make sure that the people who depended on your living to survive are not cut off from your material resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the function of life insurance. Nice and boring. But I want to end. Nice and boring. I want to, you know, start to wrap this up with like maybe one of like the key questions. If like death is the final fuck you, how can we express a final fuck you in a will? Like, what can you do in your will? Yes. You know, to just drive anything home that you want to drive home. And so like, yes, wills are about your stuff. They're about giving things to people. But I will just point out, like, if there's somebody in your life who you think is going to be a brat when you die about your money, you could put them in your will for $1. Or you could put them in your will as...
I love that you've thought about this.
Look, or like... Or you could put them in your will as like, you know, a certain amount of money is going to, oh, I don't know, say a domestic violence shelter in their name. And what's going to happen is that like, say they go to contest the will, they're there and there's a very specific thing happening for them. You know, it's not just about final fuck yous. It can also be about like final redistributions of money, because like back to this idea that like inheritance isn't taxed. You can move money to your best friend. You can move money to the BIPOC land project. You can move money to a organization that you care about. You can move money to anyone that you want. It's your will, right? So if you do have some assets, a will is also an opportunity for you to say, okay, like what do I want to see funded? If I gotta go, I gotta go. Like, where should some of this like money that I have move to?
Yeah.
So like also this final fuck you in the sense where it's sort of like, fuck you world, I'm gonna fund something that I think that matters because I'm not here to do a part that I would be doing. Death is unavoidable. The challenge that we are giving you in this podcast is to think about what are the ways that you want to prepare yourself, the people that you love, and for, you know, the people that you love's deaths. Because when you prepare, then you can do ever so much more and set other people up to not have to make horrible decisions when they're grieving. Take care of other people. Do some final fuck yous if you want.
You can also leave some final I love yous.
Mm.
You can make your will an epic trilogy of here's all of my stuff to my people and here's all my fuck yous to the people I hate and here's a final love letter to all the people I leave behind.
Right. And I want you to read this at my funeral and da-da-da. Look, like you get to pick, but put yourself in the position to pick. And make sure that the people that you love are in the position of deciding. That's what this whole episode is about. And if you want to go out in a tub of glitter, that's your choice. Oh my God, we want you to make your choices possible. That's what we have today. I'm Hadassah Damian. This has been the morbid but important Bottom Line's Top Dollars on Death.
And I'm Laura Boo. And you know what? You do you. We'll see you next time.
This has been another episode of Bottom Line's Top Dollars, a podcast made by queer punks and anti-capitalist finance professionals who, like you, don't trust money.
And are therefore obsessed with understanding it.
Your hosts are the ladies who crunch. That's me, Laura Boo.
And me, Hadassah Damian from Ride Free Fearless Money. Folks, if you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and review us on whatever podcast app you use. And speaking of money, if you are able, throw us a few bucks at patreon.com/bottomlinestopdollars.
Funds from our Patreon will pay for the costs of making and distributing this podcast. And if we grow this project big enough, for the cost of getting help to make this.
Oh, I love help and I love getting to pay for it. But other free things you can do is support us by following us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just search for Bottom Line's Top Dollars or Ladies Who Crunch.
We also have a website where we publish show notes on our blog at ladieswhocrunch.club.
Finally, if you have questions to submit for our end of season listener mail episode or feedback for us, or if you just have your own punk money stories to share, you can email us at bottomlines.club. bottomlinestopdollars @gmail.com, or just find us on one of the social media platforms and message us there.
We'd like to thank our listeners and friends who have contributed to the show, and especially to our researchers and idea sounding boards, Ariel Federo and Handy Levine.
And remember, friends, punk's not dead, but capitalism still sucks. And if what you heard in this podcast sounded familiar, you're not alone. Thanks for listening.